Want a chance to win £250 in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be £250 better off.
Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. Understanding China's role in the world has never been more important or more complex. China projects itself variously as a moral global actor, a fiercely defensive power guarding its core interests, and a pragmatic opportunistic player driven by economic incentives. At the same time, policymakers in the West interpret China through competing stories, from historical cycles and ideological clashes to narratives centered on national interests and the personalities of individual leaders. These overlapping perspectives shape how the US and its partners respond to China and how stable or unstable the future might be. To discuss these issues, in November 2025, I spoke to Todd Hall, Professor of International Relations at the University of Oxford and Director of the University of Oxford's China Center. We explored what he calls China's three personalities, the politics of emotion in international relations, and the narratives that shape US-China competition. We also talked about economic interdependence, climate cooperation, and how shifting perceptions influence policymaking on both sides. We had a fascinating conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. Well, thanks so much for joining us in the Ballpark today. Just to start off with, could you briefly introduce yourself and your research and work? Thank you.
My name's Todd Hall. I'm a professor of international relations at the University of Oxford, director of the University of Oxford's China Center, and also a tutor for politics at St. Anne's College. And so if the question is, what sort of research do? I would say I have sort of two personalities. One is focused on the foreign policy of China, the international relations of East Asia. And so I would say that I've long been a student of the foreign policy of the People's Republic of China, as well as absolutely fascinated with the region's international politics. The second is an interest in the intersections of emotion, affect, feeling, and international politics. And basically, my starting point for that research was the simple observation that we as human beings have a felt dimension to our existence that we feel. That's a big part of, I think, what makes us human. And yet much of the research and theorizing that I was seeing, and this was now two and a half decades ago, didn't seem to be paying much attention to that observation. And there's various reasons why, but my work has been an attempt to say what happens when we take that observation seriously and what are the implications for how we think about political behavior, political interactions, and how politics plays out on the international stage.
Thank you so much for that. So in your work, you talk about China's three personality problem. Can you talk about what these three personalities are and how they can be a problem for China?
So this idea of the three personality problem stems from work I am doing with Hannah Bailey of Carnegie Mellon University. And our departure point was that we were interested in how the PRC appeared to be seeking a larger leadership role on the international stage. And to use the PRC parlance, it was seeking to move closer to the center of the world stage, Zoljin Sijie Wu Tai Zhongyang. And a key part of this is this discourse they were propagating of what's called the community of shared future for mankind, also has made appearances in translation as the community of shared destiny for humankind and such, the Renlei Mingyun Gongtongti. And this has become, in fact, a key task of PRC diplomats to promote this discourse across the globe. And the rhetoric around it, I would say, is quite abstract. And sort of the basic tenet, and here I'm quoting from PRC official sources, is that countries should rise above their differences in history, culture, geography, and system, and work together to protect the Earth, the only inhabitable planet for us all, and make it a better place. And this community of shared future for mankind, or shared destiny, has sort of become the narrative spine linking together these various initiatives the PRC is also promoting on the international stage. And there's now four of them: Global Development Initiative, Global Security Initiative, Global Civilization Initiative, and most recently, the Global Governance Initiative. And the language of these is also quite abstract, but it's clear that what the PRC is pushing forward with this is somewhat different than one might call the tenets of what was a or is a liberal order, in that it's much more focused on notions of sovereign non-interference, development as a human right, and value stability over individual human rights, etc. And so in advancing all these things, the PRC is very much presenting itself as this moral actor on the international stage. And of course, this is one that also emphasizes the PRC's ties to embeddedness in the global South, whereas it contrasts this then to the United States, which it portrays as a sort of this wanton, capricious, power-wielding hegemon, or in PRC parlance, Bachuan. And so in short, we have this PRC portraying itself as this generous moral actor on the international stage. And in many ways, Hannah and I found it was somewhat adopting the tactics of what you might actually see an opposition party adopt. So having its own slogans and manifesto of how it wants to reform the international system, seeking to speak to disaffected and ostracized parties in the international system, and also while still avoiding offering concrete solutions, and also constantly being on political columns saying how the United States is doing things wrong. And so there's this very interesting way in which the PRC is sort of advancing itself as a alternative, or advancing an alternative to what would be a US-led system. Now, that's where we started off, but we found that this is one of the faces that the PRC is presenting on the international stage, but there is another. And you may recall that Xi met Biden, and at that time, he outlined four red lines for the U.S.-China relationship: the Taiwan question, democracy and human rights, China's path and system, and China's development, right? And these are things that one might consider a distillation of the PRC's broader, what it calls the Hsin-Li core interests. And these core interests include sovereignty and national security, economic development, and the leading role of the party. It encompasses core issues like Xinjiang, Tibet, Hong Kong. And if you infringe upon any of these, you're very likely to see a very different face of PRC diplomacy. And it doesn't skimp on the rhetoric when discussing these things. Consider Xi's words that, and I quote, "We will never allow anyone to bully, oppress, or subjugate China. Anyone who dares try to do that will have their heads bashed bloody against the Great Wall of Steel forged by over 1.4 billion Chinese people." This is a slightly different rhetorical tone than the community of shared future. So this, of course, is linked to a larger story of China's rejuvenation and standing up to bullies and not allowing itself to be bullied. And of course, is linked to the rhetoric of the century of humiliation, the Banyan Guoche. And it's this notion that China has to show strength and needs to be firm and push back against those hostile forces out there that would harm it or try to make it look bad. And so you have one sort of personality that's this moral personality, but then you have this other personality that's very much about, one might call it the dare to struggle, the Ganyu Doljung's personality. And it often is a form of sort of reactive assertiveness to perceived infringements on the PRC's core interests. And so we saw there's these two real sort of almost Jekyll and Hyde faces of Chinese foreign policy. And I think anyone who's had any significant period of diplomatic engagements with the PRC would recognize this immediately. But there's a third one as well. And this is sort of an overflow bucket in some ways, but it's a much messier personality. And this is something also that I think forms part of how the PRC is engaging and presenting itself, or how it forms the perceptions of the PRC on the international stage. And this is a much more sort of striving, opportunistic China. And this China is, this PRC, for example, is one that's often seeking profit, or is made up of actors seeking to meet their KPIs, their key performance indicators within the PRC system. And this is, for example, is the PRC that, despite apparently friendly relations between Xi Jinping and Putin, drove a hard deal with Russia on natural gas prices. It's the PRC that's the source of companies and actors across the globe that seek to gain market share and make profit, or are acting according to incentives in the domestic setting on the international stage. And these are ones, you know, meet earned earn money to meet performance targets, to reap personal or corporate benefits. And so you have these three ways in which the PRC is engaging with the world. And in some cases, they can reinforce one another. Certainly, you can see certain elements of the PRC's core interests represented in how the PRC wants to change the international system. They can also be at odds. They can work in counterproductive ways. And certainly, too, you have situations where PRC actors may be working in local environments seeking a profit that doesn't necessarily present the moral image that China wants to present. represent, or alternately that the firm pushback against what it sees as infringements on the core interests may not present the peace-loving face that it's trying to promote. And so this is sort of a shorthand for making sense. It's a heuristic in some ways in making sense of the different ways the PRC is presenting itself. But I think it also corresponds to different drivers in the system. One is this, again, this desire to have a greater leadership role. Another is the desire to push back against infringements and core interests. And the third is one that just seeks benefit and opportunity. And so that's sort of what we meant by the three personality problem.
Thank you so much for that. If I could just maybe ask a side question, is the picture you're painting is on one side, kind of almost a defensive reaction against the US, and then also an attempt to sort of mold a global order towards something that China's maybe will benefit more, maybe will be able to influence. To what extent is each a factor? Is it more about the defensiveness or more about global leadership?
I want to be clear, though, the defensive assertive is not just vis-a-vis the U.S. And there was a slightly cynical map made by, I forget who exactly was the source of this, but it showed all the countries who had hurt China's feelings over the years. And it's quite a patchwork. And of course, this is speaking to that language of core interest. It's not just Washington. It's right now, if there's a major row going on between Tokyo and Beijing about comments made by the new prime minister, Takaichi, about Taiwan. And they're also reacting quite forcibly. I would say that often that the core interests are the core interests in the bottom line. And certain things like Taiwan and others, it is unlikely that the PRC would cede ground on these. And so when push comes to shove, there will be concerns about making sure that A, you're protecting the status of the party within the Chinese domestic environment and protecting what are perceived to be national interests to which the legitimacy of the party is tied. But that said, I mean, you do see ways in which they can, that things done by actors seeking their own benefit or seeking KPIs may not always advance those interests as well.
Looking ahead, do you foresee any challenges or problems that might arise from China's three personality problem and its position on the world stage at the moment?
I mean, I think it will be interesting and tricky, you know, how you manage both this attempt to defend national interests. And you see this already, you know, in the South China Sea. It has territorial claims that are not completely defined, but overlap very clearly with a whole soupole of other claims from various Southeast Asian littoral states. And on the one hand, there's a lot of language about improving relations with those ASEAN states in this, but also that it's running up and there's frictions between those states, particularly in most recently between the Philippines and the PRC over certain maritime claims. And so managing those and managing that need to sort of be assertive and show that you're not giving any ground on core interests while at the same time trying to present this benevolent, peaceful, and of course Xi Jinping has said, you know, the peace is in the genes of the Chinese people. I think it is going to be interesting to attempt to balance that. And actors do run afoul of that. And that does cause problems for the PRC. And we've seen that most recently, for example, here in the UK with everything from, what was it, the Manchester consulate incident to the recent incident concerning academics where the PRC tried to interfere with their research. And of course, that was seen, I think, probably as protecting core interests and protecting the PRC's image. But that runs up against, again, this other, how should I say, the face that the PRC is trying to present.
Just thinking about in terms of the awareness globally about these sorts of initiatives, I wonder how many of our listeners necessarily would be aware of these different initiatives if they weren't close China watchers. Do you think there's a danger out in the West of seeing China as a monolith and not seeing those specific initiatives, which are actually really important?
Well, there's two things there. And one is the issue of seeing China as a monolith. And that's not just a symptomatic of the United States. I think there's a lot of places around the world that sometimes do that. And of course, the PRC itself often tries to project that image in terms of how official and quasi-official sources speak about what China thinks or what the Chinese people think and the way in which there is a certain adherence to certain narrative scripts by official and quasi-official actors outside of China, not to mention the opacity of the system, which then allows you to sometimes imagine that there's not. And it's very likely that there is disagreements. I mean, everywhere is politics and everywhere is disagreements. And we see ripples on the surface of that. And taking that into account is always important, but it's much more difficult in the PRC system to know what exactly those fault lines or debates may always be. And sometimes, I mean, there's, if you pay close attention, you can see some of these things. I always find it an interesting parlor game to sort of look at when there's state statements in official documents that say, you know, there are people who say, there are people who say X, Y, or Z, and they are wrong. And yet you've never heard anybody saying that publicly in official sources. And so you know that there's some debate going on. This is an attempt to intervene in that debate, right? But it's not just that. I mean, there are certainly the sources and signs if you're willing to look for them. That's separate from the issue of these initiatives. And that gets to a different issue, which is the PRC is doing a lot and it has a lot of different initiatives. I think many of them are still quite amorphous in their details too. And so there's not a lot to, unlike the Belt and Road, these are still in some ways quite abstract, although some of them are changing. And certainly Global Development Initiative and others, there is increasing substance to them, but it is something that's not exactly attracting a lot of reporting outside of the PRC. I guess I'd make one last point too, which is it is also interesting, you know, that given sitting in the UK, and this is not simply the UK, of course, you'll hear about Xi Jinping. You don't hear a lot about other actors in the PRC system. Whereas you compare that to the United States, and people in some cases know very obscure senators or congresspeople from very obscure districts and what they've recently said about this, that, or the other issue. And so I think there is a just simply because of the media environment and the coverage too, there's a lot more familiarity, for example, with the United States than there is with China.
So in your 2021 article for the International Studies Quarterly Journal, The Politics of Emotion in International Relations, Who Gets to Feel What, Whose Feelings Matter, and the History Problem in Sino-Japanese Relations, you outlined the complexities of historical legacies in international relations. Could you talk about what the politics of emotions are in terms of these political disputes between countries?
So that was an article stemming from an observation. And so Harold Laswell had the aphorism that politics is who gets what, when, and how, if I'm not misciting him. And ours was the observation that there is a politics of that nature also about feeling an emotion. So basically, when we talked about the politics of emotion, we were talking about arguments within political settings, both domestic and international, over the rights to feel certain things. I have a right to pride, or I have a right to anger. The obligations to feel, you should feel shame, you should feel pride even, or you should feel regret. And also the hierarchy of emotions. And by that, what we meant is whose emotions matter, the ways in which we have to pay deference to certain actors' feelings over others. Think about the feelings of the victims, or think about the feelings of the veterans, or the feelings of children. And so the notion that certain people's feelings matter more in politics, and also in some cases become the object of politics or justification for certain policies, that we need to do this because how would such and such feel otherwise? In some cases, those actors may not even have recognizable feelings because, you know, how would the war dead feel? Well, I mean, we could have arguments about whether or not war dead feel or not, but that's speaking on behalf of those actors as opposed to those actors speaking themselves. And so we were then interested about how this plays out on the international stage, and we looked to what's called the Rekishi Mondai in Japanese, or the Li Shiwenti, the history problem in Chinese, and how that had evolved over time, starting with the establishment of diplomatic relations between Japan and the People's Republic of China, and extending to the present day, and how what was initially codified as an obligation for Japan to reflect upon its behavior previously and some obligations towards that. And that was, in fact, there were in the original negotiation of the establishment of diplomatic relations, there's already a back and forth on what that language should be about what Japan should feel. And they landed upon the language of reproach itself and to reflection. And so this notion of, in Japanese, it's hansei suru, in Chinese, it's fanxing. And so how that sort of set the stage for different expectations, and then how over time those expectations came to change. And you even had in Japan the growing right-wing backlash of our children have a right to feel pride. You have a right to feel pride in the nation. You shouldn't have to be forced to engage in this type of masochistic history. And so this assertion of emotional rights vis-a-vis attempts to impose what one might call certain feeling rules about Japanese should approach or feel about the wartime past. And it was looking again at how that evolved and how that actually became a source of conflict, the disagreements about who should feel what and whose feelings matter too. And of course, you'd have actors on the Chinese side saying, well, you know, look at how we suffered. Our our feelings. Of course, our feelings matter. And it was looking at how that was a dimension to what had been previously seen as an argument over historical fact. And this idea, too, I think that was very strong, particularly in the 2000s, as the two sides could just somehow, and there were attempts to bring historians together and just agree on the historical facts, or if Japan should just give the right apology and get that apology over. And, you know, if the apology came across as completely sincere and was the perfect tone, then the issue would be resolved. And in fact, what we found was no, it was this ongoing struggle about what are the norms and feeling rules in the relationship. And when there were perceived violations of that, it could always set off again, it could trigger these conflicts in the relationship.
Is there ever a disconnect between perhaps people who are doing the negotiating on the kind of the diplomatic side and popular feeling? I guess what I'm asking is, sometimes is it easier to suggest there's a certain emotional resonance, or maybe is this overinflated at times? Does that happen in these sorts of circumstances? Who gets to represent the emotion of a nation? Who speaks for it?
Now that's the point, because the truth is, and this gets to another paper I did with Andrew Ross, and we make the basic argument that people's emotions are massively messy. And therefore, in political processes, that representation, that speaking for or speaking about becomes very important. And this comes in several ways. And so in the paper that Andrew Ross and I were doing, we're actually saying, you know, when people talk about popular emotion, often they talk about it in one of two ways. One way we can talk about popular emotion is that these are the true feelings of the nation. And you often get this language in times of crisis. This has brought us together. This is our real true solidarity, you know, post 9/11, during COVID, that this is the real moment where you see the feelings of the nation or the feelings of this group. And so these are how we truly feel. And this shows what's authentic and real. And then we call that communal, the discourse of communal emotion. And then there's this other story that we tell about popular emotion, which is, okay, there's this mass or group of people, and you have to be careful because they could be easily misled, and their emotions will lead them astray, and they'll do stupid things, or they'll do dangerous things, and their emotions could be manipulated. And so we have to be very careful to make sure that they're guided or somehow contained, because these mass emotions will lead you to do things that are irrational or dangerous or just plain idiotic. And you think about discourses about popular anger or populist anger. On the one side, you have, well, these are the real Americans, or these are the real heart and soul of the country, and they feel angry because they've been neglected, and this is the true essential feeling of those. And then there's the other side, which has the sort of mass emotions. They've been misled. They're doing this out of fear because they've been fed these lines and all these things. And our sort of statement in that paper, and we were looking at actually the war enthusiasm and how war enthusiasm prior to World War I was represented, particularly post-fact, and sort of the conservative nostalgia in Germany about the period in August when there was mobilization for World War I. And it was very interesting because whether you called it communal emotion or mass emotion told you less about what people were actually feeling and more about the ideology of the person using that. And so how you label this or how you represent this can also tell you a lot about, you know, the ideology of the actors who are then imposing this discourse on they are feeling this. This is this type of emotion and representation of emotion. And so, in fact, Carl Gustafson and I have since done further work on the politics of emotion. We had to add several categories, but one of the extra categories we added was this notion of also how you're sort of presenting or representing and moralizing either your emotions or others, because that also is a political move. You feel this, and this is something that's negative, or I feel this, and this reveals something positive or more about my character, or how could you feel this? You're showing these emotions, reveal this, how you're lacking morality or something. Your lack of sympathy shows that you're a depraved actor or such. And so there's also that sort of struggle over attributing emotions as well.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win £250 in vouchers.
Moving to another aspect of your work, you've done work on the stories that foreign policymakers in the US and Europe tell themselves about US-China relations. What are these stories?
This is still something very much in progress and something I'm playing with. But I did notice that there's certain repeated stories that we do tell about making sense of U.S.-China relations. And which story you tell also has consequences for what you think the future holds, what policies either of the actors should be adopting, etc. And so a first common one is just sort of this forces of history, great powers rise and fall, and China is this rising power, and the U.S. is this established power. And because of that, you know, you're bound to see conflict, and sort of almost a teleology of conflict, because this is how history, you know, these are the cycles of history, and we're in this cycle of history, and therefore we're facing a potential clash of the titans. And one sees this, Graham Allison's Thucydides Trap is sort of a classic example of this story. But it sort of underpins, you know, this notion that there's this historical inevitability to this. There's that story. Then there's a story that we tell, well, actually, no, it's not about rising and falling powers. It's about the fact we have two different systems. And it's almost sort of a Cold War redux, sort of China is communist and, or at least it's, I mean, I think the language one hears more is illiberal or authoritarian, and the United States is democratic. And it's this clash of democracy versus autocracy, I think. And that was, you saw that certainly in the Biden administration. And it's sort of almost a variation of a clash of civilizations discourse that emphasizes, you know, these ideological and governance issues that just can't be reconciled. And so they're bound to, in some ways, come into conflict. And part of this, too, is then this notion that you almost have this ideological security dilemma. So the things that one side does to make its position or the position of authoritarian countries or democratic countries stronger in the international system leads the other to feel more domestically insecure, that then drives this competition forward. There's a third that's this interest is what I call it. And it's this idea that we have both, the idea that there's national interests on the United States side and national interests on the PRC side. And if you sort of just grasp what those national interests are, then, and this is sort of the deal. And this story, I think, plays in, because you can't really make a deal in a clash of systems story or forces of history story. But if it's about interests, then, well, they can make a trade-offs, and the United States gets this and PRC gets this, and they agree to deal with these issues in these ways. And as rational actors, you could somehow manage and avoid miscalculations. There's a variant of that too, which is almost this, if only there was more trust and understanding, and if they could just see, we know what their interests were, and there's trust and understanding between these two sides, then somehow we could reach some accommodation and things would be better. And so those are the first three. Then there's three left. And one is this idea that there's a key issue that's just, This is the thing that has destroyed China-U.S. relations. I think a few years ago, one might have said it was Xinjiang, and that, you know, the PRC had crossed the Rubicon on Xinjiang, and that the human rights violations were just too extreme. One might have said it was Xi Jinping getting a third term, and the idea that the PRC is now on a different path, and so this is the PRC is doing something different now with how it's governed than previously, and so this or Taiwan issue. I think probably now Taiwan issue is probably pointed to as the major sort of issue. If it wasn't for the Taiwan issue, well, you could reach accommodation on these other issues. There'd still be competition or such, but it wouldn't be as heated or dangerous. Then there's a variant of that, which is sort of the not me, it's you, which is, you know, it's your domestic politics. It's your need for legitimacy. And you see this on both sides. The PRC can point to Trump and populism and these things as drivers of conflict in the relationship. The U.S. side can point to Xi Jinping and getting a third term and the party's need to legitimate itself and other things, and the ways in which the PRC has changed in the past decade or so as the cause for this. And the last one, I think, and this is fairly recent, but is increasingly significant, and that's the great men story, and Xi Jinping and Trump. And, you know, it's their personalities and their issues both, and that will determine the course of relationship. And in some ways too, this gets to a story, well, if Xi Jinping and Trump were to disappear from the scene, or one or the other were to disappear from the scene, we'd get a completely different relationship. And it's because, but it's these major personalities centered in these increasingly personalized political systems that are determining the course of relations. And they're all different stories. And I think probably we've, you know, I don't know about you, but you hear them, you know, repeatedly and sometimes in a collage mixed and matched, but they actually do tell very different causal stories of what's going on in Sino-US relations.
Thank you. I have a few questions about the various stories themselves, but just before I ask those, I want to ask, why do these stories, in the way that they're constructed, have such an appeal?
I think we're just storytelling. This is me speaking as an individual, not as an academic, but, you know, stories are how we make sense of the world, and they have a certain appeal. And each of these stories point to certain things that you can identify and are in varying ways salient at different points, and they help us make sense of what's going on. And I must admit, I probably fall, you know, I mean, and we do tell stories. That's how we make sense of the world.
So China and the US are deeply, deeply interconnected in terms of trade, really, far more so than the US and, say, the Soviet Union were during the Cold War. How much of a clash can there really be when these connections and this interdependence run so deep?
I mean, it's an interesting question. It gets to the differences between, you know, we had with the Cold War, you had a situation where the US was building up a system of interdependence and nascent globalization with a series of actors, partners, allies, etc., that excluded what was its major political rival and those associated with that bloc, more or less. With the collapse of the Cold War, then that was extended to basically the entire world. And now you're in the situation where to move into a situation that was that is that clash again, you'd have to pull a lot of that back. And it's very different to build it up compared to trying to dismantle it. And it is an interesting question of how things will move forward, how much of that will be dismantled. I think you are seeing, at least in terms of where things are headed at the moment, there are moves both within China and the United States to try and shield themselves from the vulnerabilities created by interdependence, protect certain assets that would be seen as strategic advantages, and also avoid helping the other side gain any further support to their military development. And if you play that out, that is going to be a very different world than the world we live in right now. And so we're seeing sort of a truce on some of these things at the moment, but the underlying issues remain. And it's hard to imagine all of that being disentangled and falling apart. But at the same time, it also is hard to see how the political tensions and pressures won't also put more stress on those connections.
And then thinking about interests and having China and the US having national interests that are in competition and conflict, what then about one of the biggest global interests, climate change? Where does that fit into this story or your stories?
Well, this would have been part of the interest story, right? That this would be a common interest, et cetera, under a Biden administration or under an Obama administration. Under the Trump administration, this has fallen by the side. And of course, you know, here sitting in the UK, one of the common things that people talk about when they say, well, there's still possibilities for cooperation with China, often one of them is climate, others are health and such. But this then does remove one of those areas that could conceivably have been perceived as a area of cooperation. But even that has its difficulties because then you're raising issues of dependencies that could be leveraged as vulnerabilities and the issues of secure supply chains for critical infrastructure and all these things. And even in things like EVs, there are concerns about, you know, when in a world of network technologies, could EVs pose certain risks should conflict emerge between the two actors? And so one would have hoped that, you know, there's certain things that could be done. And there certainly could have been areas of cooperation on climate change. But these two, unfortunately, even if we were in the world where we had a US leadership that was interested in doing much more on climate change, there would still be some obstacles as well.
And thinking about you're talking about the key issue, and that seems to be evolving and changing as well. From what you said, it sounds like the key issue is often from the US or the West's point of view. Is there ever any alignment between the US and China as to what the key issue is in terms of they both see one thing, say Taiwan, as being the key issue?
I think, I mean, Taiwan certainly comes up. Yes. I mean, you look at Xi Jinping's, what was it? The four red lines. The first red line is the Taiwan question. As I mean, Xi Jinping tells us it's four red. So four red lines says there's basically four key issues. And in fact, those are, I think, things that the US, you know, the Taiwan question, democracy and human rights, China's path and system. Those are things that US actors or commentators probably would also easily recognize. And even the fourth one, China's development. Well, if China develops in certain ways, that could have an impact on US's position in the world economically and strategically and technologically as well. And so certainly those, but Taiwan issue has been a major issue, but I don't think there has ever been an absence of concern about a ideological challenge or the desire to destabilize the political system in the PRC as well.
And what's likely to be the next key issue? Is it the chip war that was unfolding in recent years, or is it going to be something else?
Well, again, to be clear, I'm not endorsing the key issue narrative. And so this is not me saying that there is a key issue. This is rather saying that you sometimes see people attributing this to, and of course it can shift repeatedly. But if you were to go to Washington, and I admit I haven't been recently, but looking at what it's coming out of Washington, I could imagine that it wouldn't be too hard to find some people who would say that Taiwan is key issue. Maybe some others would say the key issue is technological competition too. So I'm not sure I would endorse that narrative myself. I think each of these narratives points to certain key things, but at the same time, each of them also have their flaws, in part just by the fact that they don't highlight the other things that the other narratives are pointing to and try to simplify it. And I think actually bringing these narratives together also points you to the ways in which this is actually the overlapping of these different things means that we're actually in a much more complex and complicated space.
And just finally on these stories, this idea of great or not so great figures, you mentioned Xi and you mentioned Trump and how determinative they are of how things are unfolding. I suspect that is a very attractive story for a lot of folks. But is it likely that figures that are supposedly great or influential have less of an influence than people think they do?
I am myself really debating the answer on that one, because in some ways, too, it's a function of how the systems align to reflect and enable them to be key decision makers as well. And so if you have a system that's heavily institutionalized with lots of restrictions upon what decision makers can do, and they're entangled in legal bureaucratic structures and the various demands of constituencies and all these things, it makes it much more difficult to have those types of influence that you swing the system wildly from one side to the other. And so there are then two questions. One is the extent to which either Trump or Xi have that ability. And we're seeing within the US, there are attempts to push back in terms of taking things to the courts or calling Trump out on certain things. But the story's not over yet. And we don't know how far he will be able to affect change. You could say the same thing for Xi Jinping too, that the PRC system is opaque, and to what extent Xi Jinping is unencumbered versus still sees himself or finds himself having to take into account certain constraints on what he wants to do and where he wants to take the PRC, either due to the way certain interest configurations still exist or just how to keep PRC on an even keel is a big question. But then there's this other side of it, which is if they were completely enabled, how far would they veer? And that also is an open question. And so is it the fact that there are still some restraints or constraints, or is it that they haven't veered completely and we just haven't seen it yet? And so it's a combination of those two, I would think. But I'm speculating here.
Well, before we finish, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
So I guess forgive the blatant promotion, but I would be remiss in my role as University of Oxford China Center Director to not encourage your listeners to check out our website and sign up for our events list and newsletter, because I'd like to think we put on quite a good showcase of lectures, seminars, and other events that look at all aspects of China, broadly understood, not just the political and the present, but sort of a whole of China approach to China studies. And so I would definitely encourage those listening to check us out. Thank you.
Our listeners can find links to that in our show notes. Just remains for me to say, Professor Todd Hall, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
Thank you.
Todd Hall is Professor of International Relations at the University of Oxford and Director of the University of Oxford's China Center. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Todd Hall for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan US Centre, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Avad Fatah. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at lse_us. And tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan US Centre or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening. Hey,